You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring Digital Strategy Bootcamp. This day-long, intensive, and interactive workshop helps you ground your digital marketing with a solid strategy that you can share with your team. Learn more and register now at branddrivenbootcamp.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Barbara Apple Sullivan. Barbara founded Sullivan in 1990 after spending more than a dozen years on the client side in the financial services industry. Recognizing a gap in how she was being serviced, Barbara understood that there was a need for agencies dedicated to helping complex businesses reach customers and prospects through the sales funnel rather than simply focusing on high-level brand and awareness building. With this in mind, she launched Sullivan & Company and has grown the agency into a highly strategic group of nearly 60 employees serving clients across the financial and professional services, technology, higher education, industrial, and lifestyle industries. Current clients include American Express, Merrill Lynch, Cornell Tech, Duke University, and Crown Castle, among others. Prior to founding Sullivan, Barbara held senior-level marketing positions at Chemical Bank and American Express. Barbara received her MBA from Harvard Business School and is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School with a BS in Marketing and Management of Entrepreneurship. Barbara, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So in going through the list of clients, types of clients that you serve, you've got financial, professional services, higher ed, you obviously have an affinity for complex industries. How is branding, an already complex task in and of itself, different in some of these even more complicated industries?
I don't think it's different, but I think it's often overlooked or shortcuts taken when what we call ecosystems are really complex. The idea of branding is really about understanding who your audiences are and creating a value proposition that is unique and sustainable over time. And that is true whether you're selling bubblegum to an individual or you're selling higher ed to a very complex ecosystem of potential students, potential faculty, current faculty, donors, parents, alumni, etc. But I think it's always about really understanding that value proposition and making it unique and sustainable, however your ecosystem is created. And I think for branding in complex products and services, in many cases, marketers simplify or oversimplify and think about the end constituent and not necessarily the entire ecosystem. And that's really what we're good at, is breaking down and dissecting who the constituencies are and what do they need to know in order to do the thing that we want them to do.
You know, you talk a lot about being customer focused, and I think that that's something that people kind of nod along with a lot. But how do you actually walk that talk of being a customer-focused business?
I am so glad you asked that question. I think one of the unique things about Sullivan is how we do that. And it's really an ethnographic approach. It's not only about quantitative research and data. In fact, there's so much to talk today about the role of data in understanding the customer and in making decisions, that what scares me is we're losing intuition and the importance of intuition in understanding how customers behave and what their personalities are like and being able to predict what their behavior will be. So we like to really roll up our sleeves and get our hands dirty and go in and meet customers and prospects face to face to to see the environments in which they're operating, to go on sales calls, which in many of these complex products and services, there's a frontline sales force that's involved in the sale, so that we can really understand who the decision makers are, what that decision-making unit might look like, the actual economic buyers and also the influencers, the kind of environment, how they're seeking information and sharing it with their other co-decision makers, and really understanding the behavior and the personas, if you will, of these customers and prospects.
I'm glad you mentioned personas, because that was something that I saw, too, on the Sullivan website that I wanted to ask you about, because I feel like there's all of these things that people kind of grasp at a very basic level, like you indicated earlier, things that are often overlooked. People talk about, understanding your audience, creating personas, that's a good thing. But I think it's also a lot of work, so we kind of nod along and sometimes just move on. But can you talk a little bit about the roles that personas play?
Sure. I mean, it is so fundamental to realizing brand value. And what we see is so many companies are very focused on defining and codifying a brand, what it means, what it stands for. But oftentimes, and usually that's done in some competitive context, but it's really done at a 30,000-foot level and without understanding what that brand means to individual buyers, customers, and prospects. So to us, the idea of, well, first of all, marketing and branding starts and ends with the end consumer or customer, whether that's a consumer or a business. And personas are a way of knowing who that audience is intimately, so that you can create the message and create the value around the brand in a way that's meaningful to those people. And at the end of the day, why I started Sullivan was because in my roles in client companies, I saw there was a lot of attention paid to creating the brand at the 30,000-foot level. But ultimately, it's not until that cash register rings, when the brand is touching a customer or prospect, and that customer or prospect decides to do something, to buy a product or service, or to become a customer, or to become a more loyal customer, that brand value is realized. So to us, branding is this marriage of the customer relationship based on personas and that understanding, and the value of the brand and its uniqueness in its competitive set.
So can you tell me a little bit about, when you talk about personas, what's the actual output there? Is it, you know, you hear some extreme examples of, like, you know, these crafted personas and like a cardboard cutout of a person. What does a really useful persona look like from your perspective?
Sure. Really useful is a very important and key word in this. And I would say we do not have one way of doing personas. Most of the work we do is based on this intimate understanding of customers and prospects. Often it includes some aspect of personas. Some cases it's more elaborate than in other cases. So there is no one template, and we think about our work in more of an evergreen way. But it's really about the behavior, the attitudes, and the perceptions, as opposed to just the demographic characteristics of who these people are that we're trying to reach. And it's not only about what they think and what they believe, but it's also how does that affect how they view their role or their usage of a particular product, and what are they likely to be doing in the future based on what we know about these people. In some cases, it's videos of what these people believe, and it's also videos potentially of how they behave in certain environments. We can observe people and what they're doing. And in other cases, it's more written explanations of who these people are and what they believe. So in many cases, especially in environments where we're talking to business people, so it's more of a B2B sale, these business people have a formal title and a role in their companies. And what we also try to do is de-link the role in the company with the persona, because there can be people who perform the same role who have very different personalities and interests and needs. So we try to really look at the human being all the time. Now, in some cases, when you talked about how they can personas can be useful, especially in complex products and services where there is often a frontline or salespeople involved in this, they need to be able to go into a situation and anticipate what persona this customer prospect is likely to have. So we also help our clients marry and understand the right questions or cues that will signal what kind of a persona this particular person has, so that it's not necessarily that if you're going in to talk to a procurement manager, all they're interested in is price, or if you're going in to talk to a salesperson, all they're interested in is growth or revenue. So we really try to decouple the role in a company and what these people, based on their role, are going to need to know, and the persona or the personality of the person that we're dealing with, and based on that, what their interests and needs are likely to be.
So you talk about frontline team members, and I think that that's a great point because, as much as, you know, you can do kind of in the back rooms to build brands, they're really made or broken between those frontline engagements. So what kinds of things are you doing to kind of make sure that those dots are connected and that those people understand the customer and also understand the brand? They're really the conduit through which that, that relationship happens.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad you raised that point. I think that our whole raison d'etre as a company is really about realizing that brand potential at the 6-foot level between a company and its a product, and their customer or prospect. And in complex products and services where we operate a lot, it often is through a salesperson or a customer service person, some kind of a frontline employee. And the role of marketing in those companies is to make sure their frontline people are really understand, can represent, and can be ambassadors for the brand. And in many cases, those people and the experience that customers and prospects have with those people are a demonstration of the brand. So they're absolutely critical as brand ambassadors and as gatekeepers of a company's brand.
And I would have to think that a lot of times those people can miss some of that importance that they have, but also others in the organization, you know, further up the food chain might not always connect those dots either. So do you find yourself in a role, your team members kind of facilitating that?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest values we bring to a client is trying to bridge that gap that so often exists between sales and marketing in a company. And salespeople think that marketing people tend to sit in an ivory tower and understand less about what's happening in the real world. And marketing people feel that salespeople don't always understand the brand and the marketing principles. And I think ultimately to be successful in establishing a brand and having it come to life at that 6-foot level where customers and prospects are making decisions, it's imperative for sales and marketing to really be on the same page. And how we do that is by focusing everybody on the end customer and the constituencies that we're trying to reach. And that if everyone, who all of whom have the same objectives, can understand who they're trying to reach and what they're trying to motivate that customer or prospect to do, then it's much easier to get the whole team on the same page.
And, you know, I think that, too, you know, you think about getting on that same page, that has to be something that is kind of continuously happening as well. I mean, it's not an easy box to check, I guess.
Well, it's not an easy box to check. And I think the kinds of companies that we work for are large, often multinational companies who are very active in the market. Their competitors are doing things that will affect how they create their own strategy. They're launching new products. They're entering new segments. So business today is very dynamic. And I think that companies have to constantly be evolving to stay on par with and hopefully ahead of their competitors. And that's the whole team. It's sales and it's marketing. And I think that the digital evolution and the role of digital has democratized marketing and I think put demands on the part of customers and expectations that companies also have to meet. So it's an interesting time to be a marketer and a salesperson, but it is something that is just constantly evolving.
You know, you talk about things being dynamic and you read my mind because I was thinking of especially when we're doing all of this as well and with everything changing because of these digital shifts. I mean, what are the big changes that are incumbent on brands to understand?
Well, I think the biggest change is that gone are the days when a brand strategy can be defined at the 30,000 foot level and put in some guideline with some templates and assume that it can be carried out and can be constant. Brands are evolving every minute of every day across a variety of touch points that are digital, traditional, experiential. And increasingly, it's the end consumer who is defining the brand. So this idea of a set of guidelines that is static is really passé. And today, brands need to be active and identities need to be active so that they can respond to and morph in the environment without changing their meaning and their value.
So when you talk about, you know, a brand's architecture, what are the key pieces there that you identify?
Well, there are a number of things. And I think it all starts with, again, a clear understanding of who the end customer is and that whole ecosystem of all the constituencies, which could be customers, prospects, and there are a lot of distributors, distribution channel, and as well as employees. And employees are really an important audience that's also often overlooked because so much today, employees have to represent the brand and be the brand ambassador. And so many employees ultimately touch a customer from various angles. So I think that, you know, today a brand needs to be evasive in a company. And I think just understanding the role it plays is important for marketers. So I think that if it starts with your constituencies and an understanding of your competitive framework, the main thing for me, the core of a brand and what's fundamental to it is what is the value proposition and how is that different and sustainable? And what does it mean as a way of establishing a niche in a market, a premium price, a value proposition that can be ephemeral? And in the old days, products could be different from one another and companies could create sustainable advantage by having some kind of a copyright or protection on that product. And in today's world, there's so the development turnaround time is so quick, it's really hard to have true differentiation across products. And that puts more pressure on the brand. So there's very little about marketing that wouldn't be included, in my view, in brand architecture. But fundamental to that is a sustainable value proposition that allows a company to compete, to have something unique, and hopefully to charge a premium price.
You know, you talked about those value propositions being sustainable. And with as dynamic as we are, it seems like the old model would have been that we can have, you know, this, you know, that's what our value proposition is and always has been. Are those more variable, more dynamic these days as well?
Well, I think what a company stands for and what a brand stands for has to pass the test of time. That's not something that can change with a changing competitive framework or a changing product set. I think one of the best examples, one of our clients is American Express, where they've been known as a premium priced service provider for 50 years. how that brand is defined and the value is modulated for different products, for different segments. When they're reaching merchants, it's one thing. When they're talking to high-end card members, it's another thing. When they're talking to travel partners, it's a third thing. So the details might vary, and some of the pillars and personality characteristics might be pushed harder for one segment than for another, or one product than another. But it all ladders up to something about American Express that is really differentiated. It commands a premium price, and it's sustained the test of time.
Yeah. So really that kind of core value proposition is kind of a base, kind of a foundation off of which other, you know, new offerings, variables can be launched, but they still have that core idea at the center of everything.
That's correct. And once a company has that core idea, I think not only is it easier for them to understand how to market their products and services, but it also helps provide some guidelines about the kinds of businesses they should be in or the kinds of products that they should be developing going forward.
Now, I realize you've talked about, things that, businesses missing out, the often overlooked aspects of understanding, who their customer is. But what are other things that you're seeing as often overlooked?
I think one thing that is another paradigm that I think is not correct. I mean, there are a few things. One is this whole notion of B2B marketing and B2C marketing. And how different that might or might not be. And I think I like to say BS on B2B and B2C. Because I think that what we're talking about with brand and how to think about the end customer and develop a value proposition that appeals and resonates with that end customer or customers is the same philosophy and approach. Well, the approach will vary based on who your client is, what their business problem is that you're trying to solve or their opportunity, what their products and services are, what their distribution channel and their ecosystem looks like. And the fact that it's B2B or B2C has very little to do with it. And actually, in most business models today, if you think about it, the Apples of the world or the IBMs of the world, they have both consumers and businesses as their constituencies. So it would be hard to define those companies, even individual products within those companies, as either a B2B or a B2C. So I think just for brand marketers, this distinction should really be eliminated. I think another conventional wisdom that I would challenge is this notion of branded content. And everybody today is talking about content and the role it plays in supporting a brand. And I think it's hugely important. I'm a huge advocate of educational and informational content. And in fact, Sullivan saw this opportunity. We've always created content from scratch for our clients, but our focus has been more on sales and marketing content. But increasingly, as products have become more commoditized, more and more companies are wanting to differentiate themselves and create intellectual capital as part of their value proposition and part of their brand. And I think as they're doing that, we felt somewhat ill-equipped to be able to think about broad-scale, systematic programs that will help companies achieve that goal of differentiation based on intellectual capital. And also increasingly with the democratization that digital has provided to customers, they're taking more control over their decisions. They're doing more homework on their own, and they're demanding more educational and informational content. So we actually started a company called Imprint, which is Sullivan's Content Lab, where we create branded content as publishers for our clients. And the notion that I want to debunk is that that should be completely separate from the sales and marketing content, which it should not be. Again, if you're talking about the end customer and who those people are and what they're looking for, they're going about their customer journey, and they're not thinking about, am I going to a website or am I going to a store or am I reading something printed? Nor are they thinking about, well, is this sales or promotional content, or is this educational or informational content? It's all part of a seamless experience, and marketers need to be able to satisfy those needs and create a seamless customer journey that will demonstrate that brand.
Like you said, the customer doesn't recognize the difference between this, kind of new and special branded content versus a marketing case study that might have been sitting around for quite a while. That's incredibly useful. But yeah, I think that with it being kind of a buzz and definitely a valuable part of how we're building brands, I do think that we sometimes overthink things just a little bit and think that content is this new, special, different thing. And in many businesses, especially in some of the complex industries that you work in, I'd imagine, content's been a part of what you've been doing probably most of the time there.
And in many cases, content really is the brand. I think it puts pressure on marketers, both on the client side and on the agency side, because the content needs to be continuous and fresh. And it's not like the brand. Content is not static. And establishing the governance of content, establishing the development and the distribution, the dissemination of content, are requirements that brands have in order to stay relevant and current.
It's interesting because you talk about the complex industries with which you work and talk about content being the brand. And I think that that's why content has always been there, because there was always, a greater level of subject matter expertise required. Whereas in other industries, you can seemingly kind of graft a superficial marketing message onto something that you can't always do in some of these more complicated industries.
I think that's true. Not only the level of complication, but also in service businesses where the experience that someone has really is defining what that product is or what that brand stands for.
Earlier on, you were talking about an idea that I wanted to make sure I got back to, and that's the idea of losing intuition at the expense of big data.
Right.
It's hard not to look at a marketing and media website that's not talking about all of the great data that we have at our fingertips.
Right.
You don't want to undercut that, but what is the role that intuition plays when it comes to branding?
Well, it's a huge role. It's where the inspiration is. It's where the creativity is. It's where the ideas come from. Big data is wonderful for defining or sizing a population or statistically proving out potential demand for something that can exist already or be defined already. But I think Steve Jobs was a person that said no focus group ever created a new product. And I think that intuition is a core element of a marketing skill set. And it's really that inspiration and where the ideas come from. And I don't think it should replace big data, but I think it is certainly foundational and fundamental to being a strong marketer. And it's where ideas come from and start with that can then be verified and validated through big data.
That's a tricky one because a tricky skill set because I know as an educator, I hear all the time talking about, we need, employers needing employees with critical thinking skills. And I think that gets back to intuition. So with that being such a big part of your business, how do you encourage intuition, hone intuition on the part of your employees?
Well, first of all, we look for people who are creative, who have done things in their lives that demonstrate some level of new thinking, of creativity. We often ask questions in the interview process to see how they react to ideas that are not formed yet, or blank space, or a blank sheet of paper. We do a lot of brainstorming internally. We partner creative people with marketing people. So I think it's really a combination of things. But one of the things that we really look for in our strategists is that ability to be creative and to generate, elicit, and respond to really qualitative ideas, and to think from scratch, to challenge conventional wisdom.
Yeah, I got to think that those are probably not an easy hiring process either. I would have to think.
Well, also, it's not only is it not easy hiring process, but it's also not easy once you have people in your firm to really promote risk taking and out of the box thinking.
Right. I mean, and it's almost like the job search itself is this kind of weird window where you can find someone kind of in a chance-taking mode. But there's probably that other risk of once you get the job, once you've accomplished the objective, then you start coloring in the lines to keep that job as well.
We really encourage people to think outside the box, to take risks, and to see how it works. And I think our clients are looking for us to be creative and come to them with ideas. They're not looking for us to be an extension of their own skill set. They want us to operate as an extension of their capability, but not be like them, but to complement them. And part of what we bring to the party is creativity and ideas. So, they do too, but that's really part of the responsibility we see.
So how does the intuition side of either an individual or a team marry up with, you know, the intuition and the data? Where is the time and place for both of those?
Well, I think that, first of all, the intuition is grounded in that deep understanding of the end constituency that you're appealing to. I think intuition has to have some constraints and some guidelines and some rules around it to be effective. And for us, it really begins and ends with a clear understanding of the people that we're trying to reach, all of whom are human beings, whether they're in businesses or consumers. So I think that the ideas and the intuition comes from that knowledge. But then for us, the role of big data is more to size and scale and scope ideas that we may have generated. So it's a way of testing. It's an insurance policy and a sizing mechanism for ideas that may have been created.
So what is, you know, in thinking about brands internally at organizations as well, you know, with, you know, the democratization that social media has brought about, it also seems like there's more variables for inconsistency in that brand voice, the brand story.
Yeah.
How do you foster, you know, consistency and balance that without sounding?
Yeah, I think different companies have different philosophies, first of all, about the level of consistency that they demand in their brand and in their communications. And some are very rigid and want everything to look exactly alike across all products and channels, etc. And some are much looser. In my view, it's more about coherence and what the brand stands for than consistency. Because I think to be effective and evolve and be relevant in the various channels and scenarios, there are so many scenarios, as you pointed out, that it's about training people to understand the true value and meaning of that brand. So as they're creating it in the specific environments, it can be coherent and stand for and mean the same thing.
So rather than kind of this scripted, we always say this, that the big idea, that the big takeaway is always consistent and coherent.
Yes.
Yeah.
And always ladders up to that customer experience. That is what the brand stands for and what we want it to mean to the customers and prospects.
Where do you find when your team kind of drops in to a project? Is it on the kind of the overall experience level, or is it kind of in that foundational value proposition level?
It's almost always in the foundational value proposition level, if not before. I think one of the things that Sullivan offers clients is help in thinking through their strategies. And where we really operate is where the brand meets the product market strategy and how to use and leverage the brand across products and across markets. So oftentimes clients come to us with a business problem that they need to have solved. They want to enter a new segment. They want to launch a new product. In the case of Cornell Tech, they were launching a new university. In the case of Crown Castle, they had become a REIT and were becoming much more visible publicly and needed to deal with all of their constituencies, which are regulators and communities and property owners, et cetera. So usually it's with a business opportunity or problem that needs to be solved. And Sullivan can help them think through how to really go about attacking and defining the overall strategy. And then doing the messaging and the value proposition and all the activation across the channels. And then the closing the loop with measuring and being accountable for the results on both a macro level in terms of the business results, as well as a micro level in turning in understanding the efficacy of the marketing in each channel.
You know, so many think of branding as kind of the unmeasured aspect of your marketing, but you talk about the ongoing nature of those conversations about efficacy, and what do those look like?
Well, that's a very controversial topic, and probably food for a whole one of these seminars on its own. There are lots of ways that companies can measure brand, and there are some that measure it at the 30,000-foot level and do things like brand trackers. They measure the health of the brand. There are even one or two identity firms who have brand valuation metrics where they look at the share price of companies and try to attribute it to a brand. I'm a little skeptical of those approaches, and I think at Sullivan we take a more practical approach and try to attach brand value to actual business results as opposed to statistics or projections. But even from the standpoint of business results, there are many levels that you can look at it on a macro basis. If we're helping a company launch a new product or enter a new segment, clearly we can measure profitability or units sold or revenue in those initiatives. If we're looking at a channel strategy, there are lots of ways to look at individual return and results from the channel strategies. And I think there, just on a micro basis, it's a much more frequent thing where you're constantly looking at the return and the efficacy of individual programs in channels and modifying your program to optimize the results over time. So, and there are also qualitative things where you can ask about brand perceptions and values, et cetera, internally as well. I mean, I want to just reinforce that employees are a very important audience. And you can even measure things like their tenure, their satisfaction, and attribute that to the role of brand. So there are lots of ways to measure. I think it's most important to understand upfront what the metrics are so that you're sure you're setting in place the measurement techniques and that you're able to measure it over time based on what you're looking to achieve.
Awesome. And as we close things out, we always ask that same question of what's a brand that's made you smile lately?
What's a brand that's made me smile? I really like Google, and I love the way Google has interpreted its logo and identity in a very active way, and how from time to time, especially on holidays, it changes. You know it's Google, and you can identify with that, but it speaks to a brand that's fun, that's active, that understands its customers. It's very dynamic and alive. And this whole notion of consistency versus coherence, I think Google is a great example of that.
That's a great point, coming back to your point on consistency and coherence. And I love the idea of it being active and alive, much like this discussion itself. Where can folks go to learn more about you, Sullivan, Imprint?
Well, I invite folks to visit our website at www.sullivannyc.com and www.imprintcontent.com, or feel free to email me directly at bsullivan@sullivannyc.com.
Awesome. Well, we will be sure to link up to all of that in the show notes. Barbara, thank you for being on brand with us.
Nick, thank you.
And as always, we flip the microphone around as we close out the show, and just wanted to give a shout to the great folks over on Twitter at BrandChat, and that's hashtag BrandChat that happens every Wednesday at 10 a.m. On Twitter. Great conversations from brand builders everywhere. I found myself wandering into it this morning and had a great discussion with Danielle Rogers, Laura Kennard, and many others over there. So big shout to the folks at Brand Chat. And last but not least, you can find show notes to everything that we talked about at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over and give us a quick rating or review. Help others find the show. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital event series. Learn more about Digital Strategy Bootcamp and the industry-leading social brand forum at branddrivendigital.com right now. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.